fact, General Steel will meet or beat any price on a pre-engineered steel building of the same size and specifications. Act now, before steel prices go up. So call us today for free information.
Call 800-965-1290. 800-965-1290. 800-965-1290.
On Friday, at a bill signing event, President Trump took some questions from reporters. One of the questions was about the president providing written answers to Robert Mueller's team.
My lawyers aren't working on that. I'm working on that. I write the answers. My lawyers don't write answers. I write answers. I was asked a series of questions. I've answered them very easily. Very easily. I'm sure they're tricked up because, you know, they like to catch people. Gee, you know, was the weather sunny or was it rainy? He said it may have been a good day. It was rainy. Therefore, he told a lie. He perjured himself. Okay, so you have to always be careful when you answer questions with people that probably have bad intentions. But, the questions were very routinely answered by me. By me. Okay? To the special counsel, yeah.
And you submitted the answer.
I haven't submitted them yet. I just finished them. As you know, I've been a little bit busy. We've been in Europe. We've been working on various deals. We just finished the USMCA. If you look at that deal, which is one of the great trade deals, you'll see. You can see how happy our farmers are. We've done a lot of work in the last period of time, so we've been very busy. It's been very, very hard to find time. But it didn't take very long to do them, and they were my answers. I don't need lawyers to do that. Now, you need lawyers for submittal. You need lawyers to go over some of the answers. But they're not very difficult questions.
For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
Oh, my God.
No, two Fridays. So, yes, I'm about ready to get started on writing the grant. It takes a lot, but, you know, it's funny. I see the other organizations, as you indicate, that they support. And I'll echo exactly what you're saying. The organizations throughout Hunterdon County that they support are great organizations. And the commission does an excellent job in supporting and fostering those organizations. So kudos to them.
And they do a lot of the marketing. So if you go to their website, you can see some of the events that are coming up. I know they send out emails all the time so that people can see it through the chamber, through you know, Constant Contact, e-blasts, et cetera, and really do support even once the money is handed over, or even if the money isn't handed over, they are still promoting all these opportunities in Hunterdon County. So go to www.showkids.org, www.showkids.org, because you will learn all about SCIT. There's information about the Perry Awards that we've been talking about, tickets, shows coming up. And this is an incredible organization, and you know, it's not your local theater of yesterday. I mean, it's professional quality. We say kids, but quite frankly, if you look at America's Got Talent, if you look at American Idol, if you look at the World Dance Competition, kids are not what they used to be. And you're proving it. We're going to take a break and be right back with Carolyn and Tom of SCIT.
USA Radio News with Chris Barnes.
A procedural vote to take place in the U.S. Senate within the hour to determine whether the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court will advance to a final floor vote tomorrow. And Chuck Grassley, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Panel, says,
I've been dealing with a demolition. To your purpose.
How many people walk through life awake and knowing why they were incarnated here in this beautiful planet? Not a lot of people
not
do.
Sure where
I
this
was in my late 40s by the time I found out, but now I know. So listen to the show, and maybe
sorry,
that'll promote you to
really
awaken to your purpose. And thank you so much.
Sponsors, and then I'll tell you about what our weather is, what we can expect from that.
Hello, my name is Robert Burns. My website is bobburnspeaks.com. And I'm inviting you to listen to my show at 1 o'clock on Friday afternoons on Hunter and Chamber Radio, entitled Awaken to Your Purpose. How many people walk through life awake and knowing why they were incarnated here in this beautiful planet? Not a lot of people do. I was in my late 40s by the time I found out, but now I know. So listen to the show, and maybe that'll promote you to awaken to your purpose. And thank you so much.
On Thursday, November 8th, from 2 till 7 p.m., the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce will be holding its 30th annual Business Expo and Food Showcase, presented by PNC Bank. It will be held at Next Level Arena in Flemington, featuring over 100 exhibitors.
You're listening to HunterdonChamberRadio.com. You're listening to HunterdonChamberRadio.com, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Well, let's try the weather. Maybe that'll... sorry about this. The traffic was horrible today, so I'm in a little later. And let's try to get ourselves organized here. The program, of course, It's the Law, and it'll be followed by the sports guys. So let's see... what we can expect, and certainly the weather can't be as bad as it was yesterday. That was really kind of a shock. For the first snow, it's down. I know my plow guy still hasn't been, and thank goodness I have four-wheel drive, because I don't think I would have, I know I wouldn't have made it. So what's happening with the weather? Let's hopefully be able to see the weather, current weather. And in this area, of course, this is now our local forecast is from Philadelphia, but the weather and winter storm is departing from the northeast. Apparently, the cold front is still going to deliver locally heavy snow for the northern to southern Rockies and upper Midwest, but we shouldn't be getting this. I know that we really got hit yesterday. So what's happening today? Tonight, mostly clear. Tomorrow, we should have a nice day, mostly sunny, which is going to help with melting some of that snow. Tonight, unfortunately, it's supposed to freeze, so be very careful out there, because a lot of what is now water is going to be turning to ice, and so it could be very slick in spots. And I think that was part of the problem yesterday. So by tomorrow, high of about 45 degrees, so again, there should be melting, and then we have to be careful. Tomorrow night, low of about 28 degrees, and again, that will be freezing, and we'll again have places that were wet will now be icy. By Sunday, they say it's cloudy, high of about 43 degrees. So what's happening with snow and rain? Well, by Monday, there is, by Sunday night actually, there's a 40% chance of rain or snow, depending where you are, because the low is about 34 degrees. So that could be, depending where you are, could be lower, and then we'll have some snow. By Monday, there's a chance of rain, and then snow, and then slight chance of showers. It's supposed to be 46 degrees. So by Monday morning, there could be some snow early, then followed by showers. And by Monday night, mostly cloudy. So pretty typical weather. We don't really know what's happening Thanksgiving Day, although they are predicting that it should be mostly sunny with a high of about 44 degrees, but going out that far is always difficult. Again, Friday, however, at least now, the prediction is that it's mostly sunny with a high near 47 degrees, so that will really be helpful to get, you know, rid of any of that snow that's left. So I'm Pat Smits. The program is It's the Law. Hope you had an opportunity to listen last week. I had a great guest, Joe Eggert, and we talked about the Vietnam War, played some songs, and I think, you know, although it was a little sketchy as to how that was going to come actually get done because of I'm not used to playing music from this station. So in any event, one thing I did forget last week, I didn't bring information, and I said I would bring it. Again, I think this is something that we all should know about, and that there is a Hunterdon County Office of Seniors, Disabled, and Veterans. And so one of the programs they have is called Mr. Fix-It, and volunteers will go to a person's home and do simple repairs to help them either keep or stay in their home. So this could include minor carpentry, electrical, plumbing, etc. And this group also offers rides for doctor's appointments. They do help with taxes, income, you know, taxes, help with computers, etc. So the volunteers, and in fact, my friend, Scott Koenig, is one of the volunteers. They volunteer their time, and the program asks that the recipient pay for whatever quote-unquote hardware is required, and also if they can possibly make a small donation to help cover the program, but that's certainly not required. The person to call is Lane, or Laney, Nauman. It's N-A-U-M-A-N. And her telephone number is 908-788-1358. So this would certainly be helpful with many seniors who are trying to stay in their home and maybe having a hard time making it because, as we know, Hunterdon County is an expensive place to live, especially with our real estate taxes. So this is a program. It's from the Hunterdon County Office of Seniors, Disabled, and Veterans. Apparently that's one office. So let's, I want to catch up with some of the spots because it's very difficult to read them. They haven't updated them, but let's see what we have here. They've been crossed out to the point that I think I can read some of them. So let's play something and then I'll be back and talk about what's happening in the news.
One of the biggest decisions in your lifetime is buying or selling a house. Choosing a realtor with strong client communication, technology, and marketing skills will dramatically improve your chance of success. That's why Hunterdon and Somerset's residents rely on Joe Peters. Joe believes his clients deserve a smooth and seamless experience, not a roller coaster ride. As a Coldwell Banker sales associate with 20 years of experience, he's helped hundreds of people to achieve their goals and dreams, no matter where they were in the buying or selling process. Joe accomplishes this by approaching every transaction from a business perspective. Initially, he tries to fully understand your goals and dreams and make them his own. Then he takes the mass amount of data that's available and distills it down to a few understandable action points. And finally, he controls the entire process through technology and marketing. The end result to you is a smooth, rewarding customer experience. Let Joe show you how to take his professional expertise and put it to work for you. To contact Joe, go to jpeters.com or call 908-238-0118.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Okay, we're we're back. The program, It's the Law. And if you didn't listen last week and you have any interest in Vietnam, as I said, I had a great guest, Joe Eggert. We talked about his service in Vietnam. We also played some recordings that were made by the infantry, well, not only the infantry, but soldiers and in Vietnam at the time. They were written using mostly songs that we were all aware of back then, and they put new lyrics, and they were, you know, I think they're some of the best, I really do. And we usually forget these guys, and so this is our opportunity, or my opportunity, to say thank you. Okay, what's happening in the news? Well, there was a class certification was denied in a lawsuit over Ranbaxy drugs. And so there was a federal judge in Trenton who denied this class action in this lawsuit by users of a drug made by Ranbaxy Pharmaceuticals, and the drug contained broken pieces of glass. So not sure why that was denied, but it was denied. Probably will be up on appeal. the state of New Jersey has filed a lawsuit against Janssen Pharmaceuticals, claiming the company used deceptive practices in the sale of two powerful opioids. And so that New Jersey will probably be joined if they haven't been by other states in that. So there was a criminal law case approved for publication. As I've said to people, kind of over and over and over, if a case is approved for publication, it means it's precedent, unless it is a case from a trial judge. So other trial judges do not have to follow a case decided by another trial judge. And, of course, the appellate division certainly doesn't have to do that. The appellate division cases, reported cases, must be followed by trial judges if the same facts come up. So this is really significant to lawyers, but frankly, the unpublished cases can be extremely helpful. For example, this one could be helpful to other attorneys. The decision was written by our own Judge Mala. Those of you who remember Judge Mala. He served in Hunterdon County. He served in Somerset County before he was elevated to the appellate division. Not only was Judge Mala brilliant, I think he knew every case that was ever published and could recite them. But he was very helpful. I mean, he really was. Handled some very tough cases here in Hunterdon County, and including the real bigot who named his child after a certain despot, Hitler. I can barely even say the name. But in any event, this case that was not decided by Judge Mala, but he wrote the opinion. It's State versus Bass, and in that the defendant appealed the denial of his fourth petition for post-conviction relief. Defendant, then 14 years old, was arrested for entering a home and fatally beating the occupant to near decapitation. Defendant was found in possession of the murder weapon and items belonging to the victim. Following a hearing, the family part granted the state's motion to waive jurisdiction to adult criminal justice system. So because this young man at the time was 14 years old, a juvenile, then his first appearance was in family court. And then there's a question of whether or not, depending on not only the age, I mean, this boy was very young, obviously, but the nature of the crime as to whether or not the case will be tried in family court or meaning a hearing in family court without a jury or tried in the criminal division. So anyway, in this case, a jury subsequently convicted the defendant of first-degree felony murder and related offenses. He was sentenced to an aggregate sentence of life imprisonment with 35 years parole ineligibility. So he would be in his 50s before he was even eligible for parole. His conviction was affirmed on a direct appeal, and he subsequently filed a series of petitions. These are called post-conviction relief, and that's what he was seeking. In the present petition, he argued that the revised waiver statute should be retroactively applied to his case so that there's been a statute enacted since he was convicted, and he wanted this statute to apply to him, which would have been retroactive because he was, of course, under the prior statute. And the defendant further argued that his sentence was tantamount to an illegal life without parole sentence and contended that his rehabilitation during incarceration refuted the trial court's finding that defendant was not amenable to rehabilitation. So post-conviction relief court denied the petition without an evidentiary hearing. In other words, the court said, no, we're not going to give you a hearing. We're just deciding this basically on the argument and on the papers. So that the court found no express language in the revised waiver statute permitting retroactive application. So that was the basis for the denial. Instead, the post-conviction relief court held that the statute was procedural in nature and there was no expectation it would be applied to the defendant, who was tried and sentenced nearly 33 years prior to the statute. So at this point, this defendant had spent almost 33 years in prison. So on appeal, the question is, what did the appellate division do? On appeal, the court affirmed the denial of the defendant's PCR petition. Although the court rejected the assertion that the waiver statute was purely procedural, it concurred with the PCR court that there was no evidence the statute was intended to apply to cases that had been tried, sentenced, and affirmed on direct appeal decades earlier. So the court further rejected defendant's challenges to his sentence, noting the defendant was currently 49 years old and now eligible for parole and was expected to live for over 30 more years. So that was approved for publication. As I said, I thought, I guess that's true. Since he was 49 years old and he was apparently must have been convicted when he was 14 because he's now 49 years old. So the point is there are many, many petitions for post-conviction relief, and this one certainly did not work. There was another case that I think was somewhat interesting on real estate and environmental law, again, unpublished. In this case, the plaintiff, Thule Realty versus Tower Saran 2. The plaintiff moved for summary judgment, meaning the plaintiff said there was nothing in dispute and therefore they should be granted judgment. So when they moved for summary judgment, the defendant cross-moved for partial summary judgment. And in this case, the plaintiff's action arose from the purported termination of a purchase and sale agreement for real property. We call real estate real property. That's interchangeable in our law. So after entering the agreement, plaintiff delivered a security deposit to be held in escrow. The agreement permitted plaintiff to review the title and the survey and the environmental matters 30 days from the effective date, and to notify the defendant if it disapproved of any matter affecting the property and terminate the agreement. So after discovering the property contained an abandoned boiler lined with asbestos, the plaintiff purportedly exercised its right to terminate the agreement due to the environmental concerns, which obviously, if there was a boiler with asbestos, there would be environmental concerns. Now, however, defendants subsequently performed asbestos abatement, removed the boiler, and sold the property to a third party for the same price. Now, the parties' cross motion sought to determine whether discovery of the asbestos constituted breach of the agreement for environmental matters, and whether the plaintiff properly exercised its right to terminate in support of its motion. Now, defendant argued plaintiff never performed testing to definitively identify the boiler material as asbestos. Now, the trial court rejected the defendant's argument as not relevant to the question, noting that the party's agreement did not mandate the presence of any specific environmental hazard, nor require any testing or definitive proof of a hazardous substance. In any event, the court noted that the defendant confirmed the existence of asbestos by filing public abatement documents. And ultimately, the court ruled the plaintiff's concern for environmental matters was sufficient to trigger its right to terminate the contract. The court further ruled that the plaintiff was entitled to attorney's fees as it successfully sued to return its deposit. So that was the problem here. The defendant kept the deposit, and of course it probably didn't hurt that later they sold for the same amount of money. But in that case, now usually people have to pay their own legal fees, except in divorce cases, that's not true. And this is a chancery case, and of course the other cases, in most cases, people pay their own legal fees, but in this case, the plaintiff was entitled to fees because they successfully sued to recover the deposit. Well, you may be bombarded more with more legal advertising because the New Jersey Supreme Court's Committee on Attorney Advertising has relaxed the rules on descriptive terms that lawyers can use in their advertisements, though lawyers may be required to back up their claims. So, you know, if an attorney, for example, a personal injury attorney, says, wait, I've won 100% of all the litigated cases that I filed, you know, someone would have a right to challenge that. And the question is, did they win? Did they settle? I mean, who considers whether a settlement is a win or not? So, again, that would be a case-by-case basis. What is not a case-by-case basis, and this is significant, is that the New Jersey Supreme Court has agreed with the special master that a state police technician's errors in calibrating the ELCO test devices negate the validity of more than 20,000 breath tests performed on defendants. So that is huge. Who knows? This just came out on the 14th, so who knows what's going to happen with all of those cases. They're already reminding us about the New Jersey annual meeting and convention that doesn't take place until next May. So let's get through, you know, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and all the other holidays first. Now, the Third Circuit, of course, is the federal court. There was a nominee, Paul Matley, who faced heavy questioning about his links to the scandal plagued former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie during a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on his nomination. So this, he's perhaps being involved that closely with Christie didn't help him. There is another criminal law case, evidence case, that was, this is a 242-page decision. And in this case, the defendant moved to withdraw her guilty plea to a DUI. And she pled guilty based on the results of an alcohol test showing that her blood alcohol level exceeded the legal limit. Now, as we know, the state had been using the alcohol test since 2000. And in 2004, it developed the current calibration protocol, which was subsequently found by the court to be sufficiently scientifically reliable to permit the application of alcohol test results in DUI cases. Now, the court further, however, ordered. Now, this is interesting. The court further ordered the alcohol test devices recalibrated semi-annually to ensure accurate measurements. During the calibration process, simulator solutions were to be heated to 34 degrees Celsius, which is the generally accepted temperature for human breath. And then the test coordinator inserted a thermometer that produced National Institute of Standards and Technology traceable temperature measurements into a simulator solution to ensure that it heated within 0.2 degrees of 34 degrees Celsius. So the coordinator with the state's drug testing unit was responsible for performing the calibrations, and he was responsible in several counties. He was later charged with falsely certifying his compliance with the calibration procedures. So defendant, Ms. Cassidy, was notified that the results of her test were among those called into question, and she moved to withdraw her guilty plea. Now, the court granted the motion and appointed a special master to determine whether the failure to test simulator solutions with the NIST traceable temperature check undermined the scientific reliability of breath tests performed on alcohol test devices. So after an evidentiary hearing, the special master concluded that the state failed to prove that the alcohol test was scientifically reliable without an NIST traceable temperature check during the calibration. So the special master who, reviewed all of this said that the state failed in its burden. So therefore, creating testimony that even a few minor errors could cause undetected miscalibration.
So the Supreme Court adopted the special master's report and ordered all defendants notified that the test results from machines not calibrated with a NIST traceable thermometer were inadmissible. So that's where we come up with the 20,000 tests really have been thrown out, which means that those cases need to have a new trial. People need to have a new trial. So we had a family law case for publication, and there are not a lot of them, so of course I'm always interested in this, but if a case is published, that means that they think it's significant enough to be published. And this was, again, initials, PHVLW. Initials are used to protect children in most cases. Some other reasons, but in general, it would be to protect children. And so this was a case where the defendant appealed from the denial of her motion to dismiss plaintiff's custody matter. And the defendant originally was a resident of South Dakota, met plaintiff in Chicago, and they continued their relationship in South Dakota, where she became pregnant with the party's twin daughters. So plaintiff later returned to his home in New York, while defendant and the children remained in South Dakota. Defendant and the children moved east to live with plaintiff, initially living in New York. Then all parties moved to New Jersey after the plaintiff leased a home here. So apparently plaintiff allegedly continued acts of domestic violence against the defendant, which led her to file a domestic violence complaint. Then she subsequently left New Jersey with the party's children and returned to South Dakota. And at that point, or at some point thereafter, plaintiff returned to New York. Then plaintiff filed the present action to determine paternity and custody. So the alleged father did this. Meanwhile, the mother obtained custody of the children via a court order in South Dakota. So that's the question, of course. Did South Dakota have jurisdiction over the alleged father when the court there granted the plaintiff mother custody? So at that point, as I said, she had gone back to South Dakota, and he returned to New York. And then plaintiff filed the present action in New Jersey to determine paternity and custody. So meanwhile, as I said, the mother had obtained custody of the children via court order in South Dakota. However, the New Jersey court ordered defendant to return to New Jersey with the children for a paternity hearing and testing, actually, concluding that New Jersey had home state jurisdiction. So they had lived here with the children, of course. They had not lived in South Dakota. And then the trial court rejected the defendant's motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction and or forum nonconvenience. Well, forum nonconvenience means that this simply would not be a convenient forum, convenient court, for the plaintiff to proceed. And of course, if she won that, she wouldn't have to bring the children back. So as I said, the trial court rejected her motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction or forum nonconvenience. And the trial court held that the jurisdictional issue had been decided, and it noted that South Dakota had declined jurisdiction. I'll be right back.
Are you struggling to find the right person to stay in that critical role in your company? Trying to attract and retain millennials? Regional Personnel is your staffing solution. Located in Lebanon, New Jersey, Regional Personnel is an ASA-certified, privately held staffing and recruiting firm providing you with everything from temporary to permanent employees. As ASA-certified professionals, we employ the latest tools and techniques to find, screen, and present to you the best talent that fits your needs. The result? Access to top talent in the shortest time with the lowest chance of turnover. We guarantee it. So call Regional today at 908-534-8113 or visit us on the web at regionalpersonnel.com.
Did you know the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in? Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Are you struggling to find the right person to stay in that critical role in your company? Trying to attract and retain...
This is Tony Clark, para planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Okay, back. I'm still talking about this case, PH versus LW. And as I said, this case went up to the appellate division. So what did they decide? As I said, the trial court rejected defendant's motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction or forum nonconvenience. And the trial court held that the jurisdictional issue had been decided and noted that South Dakota had declined jurisdiction. However, on appeal, the appellate division vacated the trial court's exercise of jurisdiction, rejecting its conclusion that New Jersey was the children's home state. The court found that the children had not resided in New Jersey for 6 months prior to plaintiff's suit, and that is a requirement. In other words, you can't just come to New Jersey, reside here for a month or two, and then file saying that this is the children's home state. The appellate court further noted that the parties and children had long been absent from New Jersey and lacked a significant connection, with the lack of substantial relevant evidence present in New Jersey. In other words, these kids had not gone to school here, they'd not been here for a long time, and so the court ruled that the state had become an inconvenient form. So even though might have jurisdiction, it was an inconvenient form. And the what should have been, and I think was also significant, is that the plaintiff father had moved and gone back to New York. So in this case, neither party was residing in New Jersey, much less the children. They weren't here either. So there would be a difference if, in fact, the litigation was in New Jersey and then one party moved out of New Jersey with children, New Jersey would continue to have jurisdiction However, might still decline to exercise it if children are and have been, for example, in school for a number of years in another state. So there are two different things, whether or not a court would have jurisdiction, and then the second thing and the second prong is whether or not the this is just an inconvenient form to resolve it. There was a labor dispute that might be of interest to some people. It was published, Flansman versus Jenny Craig, Inc. This is the appellate division, and the plaintiff in that case appealed from a trial court's order compelling arbitration. So this was whether or not the parties had to go to arbitration at the time of the of her termination. Plaintiff was 82 years old, having worked for the defendant, Jenny Craig, for the past 26 years. Defendant had been gradually reducing plaintiff's full-time hours to 3 hours a week, and this reduction in hours led to plaintiff's termination. So the plaintiff filed the present complaint alleging age discrimination. Love it. 82-year-old woman says, I'm being fired because of age discrimination. And also harassment, discriminatory discharge, constructive termination, and also a better liability under the New Jersey law against discrimination. So Jenny Craig moved to compel arbitration pursuant to a purported arbitration agreement. And that's one thing that people really need to look at, is whether or not when they take on employment or anything else, they agree to arbitration. So the plaintiff opposed this, asserting that she had no recollection of signing the document containing the arbitration agreement. And the document was purportedly executed nearly 20 years into her employment. So on appeal, the plaintiff argued that the arbitration agreement lacked mutual assent and therefore was invalid. So obviously mutual assent is very important. And then as a matter of law, specifically plaintiff argued that the parties failed to reach a meeting of the minds as to what rights would replace the right to jury trial. So the plaintiff further argued that the arbitration agreement was unconscionable. Now that is very significant when something's unconscionable. So the court agreed with the plaintiff and reversed the order compelling arbitration. The appellate court concurred that the parties lacked a meeting of the minds because they had not agreed upon and what form they would use for arbitration. So that was not part of the agreement, so obviously that should have been in there. The appellate court noted that prior cases had invalidated arbitration agreements even where the designated form was unavailable, on the grounds that the parties to an arbitration agreement had to understand the rights that they were waiving. So that's very important. And the rights that they would take the place of the rights that they would ordinarily have for a jury trial. And then ultimately the court held that the consideration as to whether the parties had agreed on a form or the rights that would replace a jury trial. So the court said they just hadn't agreed. And they held the failure to appoint an arbitrator or designate a process for the appointment of an arbitrator was itself insufficient to find a lack of meeting of the minds. So, interesting case, but people should be very careful when they're signing agreements, because very often they contain an arbitration clause that, when you read it, might be very unfair. In fact, I recently took over a case, and the expert who had been retained jointly as a joint expert with in the retainer agreement, they had an arbitration clause that I would never have agreed that any of my clients should sign. And it was, so at this point, I don't know if there's going to be litigation over it. There may well be, but this was something that the attorneys should have looked at. Actually, both attorneys for both parties should have looked at this, and I find it difficult to believe that either attorney that was representing my client, the prior attorneys representing my client, or the attorneys representing his wife, would have agreed to the very draconian terms of that agreement. So what else is happening? Well, let's see. There's not of surprise, is litigation between two firms that had each represented someone in a case. I mean, one of the things that is difficult is when, in certain cases, if someone changes attorneys, not so much in family, because, of course, they're going to owe the first attorney based on that attorney's work and then owe the second attorney. But certainly in contingency cases, that can be a real, real problem. So there was also another family law case. Again, it's DCP&P, which is our old DIFAS. And that was a case where the father appealed from the trial court's review of his juvenile records and their disclosure to counsel for the law guardian of the children, and subject to a restriction on their use in the case. So in this case, this was a Title 30 proceeding, which is a DCP&P proceeding with respect to children. And in this case, the father was a biological parent of one of the children. And again, there was a question of a report concerning the child's safety in her mother's care. So in that case, DCP&P must conduct an emergency, or in that case they did. It must have been serious enough that they conducted an emergency removal. And then after a hearing, the trial court concluded that the removal was necessary to avoid risk to the child and granted custody to DCP&P. Now, they don't always go after custody of children, but in this case, they did. So the trial court subsequently ordered the father to submit to a psychological evaluation and to attend parenting classes. So the father later requested unsupervised visitation with the child, and the law guardian is appointed for the child, opposed the request based on a belief that the father had committed one or more sexual offenses as a juvenile. So at that point, the law guardian moved to release the father's juvenile records. And of course, it's very unusual to be able to obtain juvenile records. And of course, in this case, the father opposed the motion on grounds that his juvenile records were statutorily confidential and could not be released except in some very limited circumstances, and this wasn't one of them. So the court rejected the father's argument and ordered an in-camera review. Now, in-camera means that the court is going to look at these records and then make a decision as to whether or not anyone else will see them. And so what happened in this case is after the review, the records were released to counsel under a protective order. Now, on appeal, the appellate court affirmed in part and remanded to the trial court in part. So what does that mean? It means they upheld what the trial judge did in for some of this, but not for other parts of it. So what the appellate court did is they affirmed the trial court's review of the father's juvenile records. In other words, they said, yes, trial judge, it's perfectly appropriate for you to take an in-camera review of the records. And so they also noted that the law guardian's certified submissions concerning the father's possible past sexual offenses created a need for the trial court. So they said because of this was brought up, not in just some sloppy way, but in fact, the submissions that the law guardian provided validated the need for the court to do this. So the court, they agreed that the trial court should have reviewed the father's records in the interest of the child's safety while in the father's care. So that's why that is appropriate. The most important thing in these cases is the child's safety, and obviously if there was a question of whether or not the father had committed sexual offenses as a juvenile, that certainly would be a reason why he should not have the care of the child if that was borne out. However, the appellate court held that the trial court should have issued a statement of reasons supporting its decision to release the records in their entirety. So apparently the trial court just turned them over, didn't put on the record exactly why he or she had decided to do this. And the appellate court noted that the records included documents such as school records that were not relevant to the present proceedings. So the court therefore remanded to the trial court to limit disclosure to certain categories of records and order their destruction after these proceedings. Of course, that's kind of like cat was out of the bag. And, you know, so whether that's very helpful, I once had a case where there was a question of my client was remarried and filed tax returns with her, no, excuse me, did not file joint tax returns with her new husband. And the other side, former husband, wanted to subpoena those records. And the trial judge, did look at them in camera, although my client's current husband had no support obligation for these children. But in any event, not only did he look at them, but he agreed that they could be disclosed. I believe that was the wrong decision. The appellate division did not overturn that and did not remand it. So I did not, of course, represent my client's new husband, but he had an excellent attorney, and they filed an appeal and didn't win on that. So there's another case, and Bill has joined me, so I'm going to have him listen to this. Bill, this is a case, we're just about ready to end, so maybe we'll do this next week. It's a creditors and debtors' right, banking and finance laws, so you're my go-to person on something like this, but instead, let's just play the news, and then we'll get on to our program as far as the sports guys. So let's play the news. If here we go.
USA Radio News.
A federal judge on Friday ordered the White House to immediately reinstate CNN correspondent Jim Acosta's security pass, siding with the network and other news organizations. In a written response, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said there would be more decorum at the White House and some rules and regulations would be put into place. President Trump explains what she meant by decorum.
You can't take three questions and four questions and just stand up and not sit down. Decorum. You have to practice decorum.
And if not followed, what can we expect?
I've instructed my people, when they're not treated properly, you have the right to just leave.
The number of people missing in California's wildfires has soared to 600 people. Meanwhile, the death toll has also risen to at least 66. Butte County Sheriff Corey Honey joined Fox News to talk about the recovery efforts.
We're going to continue to do our absolute best to locate people and reunite them with their friends and family.
And you're listening to USA Radio News.
Hey, I'm Brant. So there's this guy named Jordan. He's a healthy guy. He's a dad of six, and he works as a guide in Alaska. And he goes to the doctor, true story, he goes to the doctor and he's diagnosed with cancer, stage 4. And here's the thing. He had switched earlier from medical insurance to MediShare, where Christians share each other's medical bills. So the question for Jordan and his wife, Jenny, was, is this actually going to work?
Our medical bills exceeded $160,000. MediShare members shared all our bills.
And it was about more than just the money, too. This is a real community.
MediShare is a family, a group of people that stick with you through the hardest times of your life. I just don't know how I could have done it without MediShare.
It's so worth looking into. There's a reason this is growing so fast. So if you want to find out more, here is a number for you. 855-90-PSALM. That's 855-90-PSALM.
Still no